Well, we know what it's like to feel worried and helpless about the state of our world.
But we're finding comfort and inspiration from people tackling winner-take-all economics and other root causes of climate change, inequity, and global unrest.
Join us on the road from wasteland to wonderland. This is Pot of Gold.
For this episode, we got the chance to speak with Christian Landy. He's been working with one of Switzerland's premier technical universities, EPFL. He's working on a startup called Air Veracity. The aim of the project is to improve the data collection process of air pollution and make that data available to local communities, empowering them to take action on local air quality. Maybe it's just best if you just introduce yourself, your name, and what you're doing in the world.
All right, sure. My name is Christian Landy. I work with a startup. I've created a startup to address urban air pollution. And our aim really is to decentralize decision-making within for people around air pollution and use air pollution as a proxy eventually to addressing climate change. My background is a commodity trader, and I've been trading commodities for 20 years, primarily energy, power, gas in Europe and in the U.S., and that somewhat formed my decisions and approaches to this topic. So when we talk about air pollution, urban air pollution, it's hyperlocal. So it can vary by 8 times within 200 meters within a city. Yet when we, when you look at air pollution on a map or from the official sources, it's often based on just a single point, which doesn't really tell you anything about the air pollution at your location. So what the startup does and what was developed here at EPFL was a 6-year pilot in which they were able to monitor air pollution on an accurately using on a mobile basis using vehicles, so attaching air pollution sensors to vehicles. And this is the sort of technology that the EU JRC said 2017 would be a game changer in terms of air pollution. The question at that time was whether or not you can make it accurate. So what the startup does is what the startup wants to do is to put air pollution sensors on vehicles, but then network that to the official air quality monitoring station. And also network downstream to individual air pollution monitors. So if you own an air pollution monitor, what happens now is you buy one and you have no idea if it's accurate at all. It could be 0% accurate, and that's quite common. And that's why, the EU JRC was kind of reticent to, put their name out there, because the technology wasn't quite there. Because what you're trying to do is you're trying to take a piece of electrical mechanical equipment that costs maybe $1,000 and replicate something that costs $150,000. Well, the only way to do that is to cheat. And the way we cheat is we dynamically calibrate with the existing sensors. So as we pass within close proximity, just like you would, like say your watch on Bluetooth, recalibrate to that local condition, sampling the same set of air. And in that sense, what we're trying to do is decentralize the decision-making process down to the individual local level, because that seems to be really the only thing that works. If you think in terms of economics and capitalism, what has worked in the last 250 years, the decentralization of that decision-making process to the individual level. So that's basically it.
That's fascinating. Okay, so I'm going to break it down a little bit, because that was a huge mouthful of information, or head full of information. But let's back up a little bit from you becoming a climate change startup entrepreneur from an energy trader. Okay, so what is that? What prompted that decision? Like, you know how energy works. You've been in Wall Street. You know how the markets work. What prompted you to pick up and start to a climate change startup?
It has always kind of been there in terms of, the understanding around renewable energy, for instance. And what really caught my attention was in 2008, around then, prior to the crisis, was the effect in China of air pollution. And we basically saw the Chinese react in a way that upended several markets, upended the international coal market, international LNG market, iron ore market, things like that, and it was their reaction to air pollution. So right around 2012, they had a huge issue, and I don't know if you recall this, but they U.S. Embassy was reporting air pollution levels in Beijing, as if you couldn't see it, but they were showing you really how high it was, and that caused a lot of consternation within the Chinese government. And then in sort of typical fashion in China, they did a 180, and they said, okay, we're going to go out and buy over 1,000 of these really expensive air quality stations across China and measure it. And then they freaked out. And when they freaked out, they started making those changes, those wholesale changes to the system to try to decarbonize, because it's primarily a coal-driven market, 90% coal-driven, and they are going to change everything. So electric vehicles start taking off. So when you start thinking about your wind and solar and why it's so prevalent now, it's really mainly due to China. The last 60% drop in prices had to do with the Chinese investing, you know, $108 billion a year in solar and wind, versus maybe the U.S. is like a 10th or 12th of that. If you look at air pollution and the urban air pollution specifically, every time there has been instances that is visible, there's always been overwhelming consensus, you know, and so we're living in the sort of politically divided world, and what you start to ask yourself, well, what's worked in the past, you know, and one of the things with air pollution, when it's visible, everyone, there's always consensus, and you can take places like, well, you know, obviously LA you'd be familiar with, that was, you know, in the 60s, or the London in the 50s, always overwhelming consensus. Some of the first LNG cargo really was from Louisiana to London to address London fog, which was not fog, it was, you know, smog, essentially, coal pollution smog. So those kind of things, you know, so trying to take that lesson from history and saying, okay, well, how can I apply that going forward? And one way I can apply that going forward is to give everyone a real-time measure of air pollution at their doorstep and give them the actionable information they can do something about it. Because, you know, often what we get caught up in this sort of climate change ideas and air pollution is like, well, what do I do? You know, it's wonderful, and it's actually that whole paradox of choice, you know, that's coined by the psychologist Barry Schwartz, was that, you know, the more choices you're given, it creates more anxiety. And then often where we are most successful is when we kind of emulate our peers. But then what do you do when the peers don't know what to do? Because I don't know, do I recycle? Do I do this? Do I do that? And more to the point is, how can I create an organization that will take that and run and create that and make that a common thing, a thing that everyone wants to aspire to, and people can see, visually recognize, take action, and emulate.
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting is that basically what you just said, where China hit saw a crisis, an air pollution crisis. It's something you can't really hide, you know, like 2008, I think you basically could cut the air in Beijing and like pack it into little bags. It was so polluted. And so, and as you, London as well, right? So you it's something you can't deny anymore. And so people hit the crisis, or governments hit a crisis, and then they take action. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I think it has to start with people, right? So when I say decentralization, what I'm trying to bring it back is to what's worked in the past with people and people taking individual action. And that's really centered around locality, because what we're really talking about here in some ways is esteem. So I want to be seen as doing something for my community. I would like to be people to visually see me doing that. And that is sort of like, if society is sort of this exchange of rights and obligations, we kind of pushing those back to the decentralized level rather than the current situation, which doesn't work, is that we all get really angry at the government, shake our fists, but, you know, nothing happens, right? Because people have to be able to take action. And even if it's only self-interested action, that is better than the status quo. And then sort of the leading by example and doing it on a community level, that's far more powerful than, you know, going up against an industry that's spending, well, I think the IMF said it costs 6.3% of worldwide GDP is subsidizing fossil fuels. And that's a lot of money. I mean, we're talking, you know, let's say 80 billion, 75 billion, or trillion, sorry, worldwide GDP. You're talking about an enormous amount of money. So, I mean, how do you go up against something like that? Well, you do it on the local level. You do it by empowering people and being people being able to be seen as doing something by their neighbors.
So empowering by basically giving them the data to see, okay, in this corner here, the air I actually live in is really bad. What can I do?
Right. Okay. So that's the actionable piece. The idea about empowerment also has to do with how you fund it, right? So right. The idea is that you would, for instance, we can put these sensors on vehicles, and that vehicle can have an LED light on the vehicle. So when people bought the Prius, you know, they had the whole Thorstein Veblen's idea of like conspicuous consumption. was turned into conspicuous conservation around the Prius and people wanting to drive that Prius because it looked green. I'm trying to apply that sort of green halo square concept to the vehicle, putting these LED lights on the vehicle. They change every few seconds to reflect the air quality of that location. People look to you to see what the air quality is at that location. Yet you're paying a premium to be connected to the network, and that's how this whole thing funds itself. So I probably didn't explain that very clearly, but it is a complex thing. The biggest issue we have with climate change and air pollution is complexity and collaboration. So how do you address those two things?
So you've been talking to cities around the world, I presume, as you think about setting this system up. What cities have been, have you noticed a difference between cities and the way they approach this kind of a startup or their perspective of the policy issues you're presenting?
Well, this is why it's so difficult, right? So when you first get into this sort of thing and you think about it like another commodity or like any sort of tradable product, it doesn't make any sense. None of it makes any sense. It's sort of a system where you have a lot of consultants involved getting paid a lot of money to create maps that don't really reflect anything accurate, and people getting upset, but to no end. And most of the cities, to be honest with you, when you talk to them, they want you to hide it. They're a bit like, we'd like that, but we don't want to make the information public. Like, we want to know so we can solve it, but we don't want to make it public, which is kind of the base, the crux of the problem, right? The crux of the problem is not the government, it's us. It's how do we fix that? We can't look to other people to solve our problems. And when we look to the state to solve all our problems, we always end up in these sort of suboptimal situations or nothing gets done because they don't have the tools nor the public backing. And what we need is more education about what the problem is. We need more accountability about who's creating the problem, not pointing fingers, but measuring it accurately and saying, okay, well, what are we going to do to alleviate this? Can we put these measures back in the traffic control system to alleviate air pollution, not just congestion? Because air pollution being so hyper-local, it changes dramatically with the weather conditions. So, you could. There's a lot of practical things you can do. And the city's reactions, 80, 90% of the time, is they're scared.
Has any city kind of been the model city that's kind of like, yeah, we want to do this, we're willing to take the risks with the transparency of our citizens, let's go?
Well, the problem is you get into this sort of silo effect, often with the governments, right? You get into these sort of silo effects. So the people affected by it most aren't necessarily the people you're talking to. So for instance, when you talk about air pollution and 6.5 million people a year dying from air pollution, you're really talking about who's being most affected. The healthcare service, is obviously a big one. From many people who have nationalized healthcare systems, that would be an interest to them, but they're not responsible for the city. Now, the city may be not even responsible for the monitoring of the air pollution because that's done on a state or national level. So this is the real challenge in this approach is not that people don't like it. I mean, when I talk to the air quality officials who I'm really wanting to put this back on because I'm saying to them, like, look, we will provide a mobile service for your air pollution monitoring, you will tell us how accurate it is because you'll have every single measure. So you define the accuracy. Because capitalism is great and everything. And I think Adam Smith's signature, like I mentioned before, his signature thing was that self-interest works, but not always, right? It's not left to its own. And so you need a framework, right? So you need a proper framework in order to do this thing. And the air pollution people would be the authority. They would be the sort of, okay, here's the level of accuracy we're happy with. And it's not 100% for these measures, but it's better than in the EU definition of indicative, which is 75%. And they kind of own that. But to get all these different disparate groups involved is a challenge. And when I talk to air quality people, the individuals, they're quite keen on it. They're like, that's fantastic, because that's what we've always wanted to do with all these crazy maps that don't tell you anything. We've always wanted to give people this kind of information, but the technology wasn't quite there. But it's a political minefield for them. There's an entire science built around whether you move the station 10 feet to the left or 10 feet to the right. And they're really reticent to get involved in that because people just beat them over the head. At least that's the way they feel. They just get, beaten over the head with the idea that there should be more stations or as if they had more control, which they don't effectively. It's done at a national level. The funding, is set aside and you have about an official air quality station for about every 250,000 people. And that's both in the US and Europe.
What do the stations look like?
They look like lab equipment. They're like small buildings, so you might see them in Germany. Sometimes they have them next to the road. They're essentially lots of lab equipment. It costs about $150,000, all these different measurement, you know, and they have to be calibrated properly, a lot of chemicals and things like that involved. Whereas the sensors I'm talking about are really just look like almost like an electronic device, a small electronic device, and they're trying to mimic those.
So how closely linked is air pollution to the general problem of climate change? Is if we solve air pollution, will we inherently solve climate change, or what piece of the pie does this represent?
Yeah, I mean that's a challenging question, because scientifically I don't even know if you could deduce how much of it is related to climate change. But the idea that we could act locally and do things on a local basis to reduce air pollution, and we could do that either through esteem or through shame, right? We could shame our neighbors into acting better. That's really the approach I'm going for. Because, you know, air pollution, you know, if we solved all the city's air, you know, issues with air pollution, we would still have climate change. You still have people burning fuels, you know, maybe, and you know, so that doesn't go away. But the sense that you can take direct action, you can measure it accurately, that's really what I'm trying to convey. And if it acts as a proxy into people's understanding of climate change and dealing with climate change, then great, because I think that's what needs to be done.
So if I have a sensor on my car or in my attached to my building, and it's showing high numbers, what is the action I would take?
Well, I mean, you could you could localize the emission source, right? So if you had that, and we knew other measures in the air, we'd know which building it was, for instance. And maybe you discover a building there in New York that's running on high sulfur fuel oil when it's supposed to be running on low. And somebody cheated, the landlord cheated, bought some cheap stuff and burning and polluting, but nobody's catching him because nobody's out there monitoring. And then you could apply that same rule you have for the vehicles to this landlord, and all of a sudden he's having to pay a fine, or she, for, you know, whatever the pollutants is for the violation. That's one example. So it's sort of community empowerment that you can sort of self-enforce that.
So, but it would require some level of municipal policy, like, you know, like a city council would pass the fines or some kind of legislation that would say how we're going to deal with that data once we got the data.
Well, it's already there, right? So they already do it for vehicles. You just extend that to stationary objects like buildings. So, you know, then the person says, okay, I think the building at this corner is polluting, burning a higher pollutant fuel. Check it out. They find out, yes, that is the fact the case. They find them, then you get a check in the mail. And it's not a new law. It's just an extension of what you already have for vehicles, for large vehicles in the city.
I think we had on the other podcast about the International Zoom Room, we had this the comment of a 9-year-old who said, the sky is getting bluer now with the crisis, climate crisis, but COVID or Corona.
Yeah.
So now the visibility is not, you know, it's kind of becomes clearer, and I think people may think air pollution is no longer an issue.
Well, the two aren't unrelated. You know, there's been a lot of studies and seen some things in The Guardian where they're looking at the two together as if maybe these, you know, viruses hitching a ride on some of these pollutants. These aren't peer-reviewed studies or anything like that, but in the sense that it destroys your respiratory system, it affects your, you know, hypertension, which is a high comorbidity to COVID. These things are not unrelated. you know, the really cool thing about all this is if you look at the history of things, it's you only need about 3% of the population who's highly engaged in this.
How many percentage are engaged in this topic now?
Well, constructively engagement, I think, is lacking everywhere. Mm-hmm. You know, because everyone has their own reality. The market for, I'll give you an example, the market for air pollution sensors is the Wild West. Everyone claims to be accurate, people have their own thing, and they have their own reality, which is kind of symptomatic of the political situation, right? We all kind of create our own reality around what we want to believe, but there's no sort of organizational force around that, right? And you need the organizational force. It's the whole idea about ethical capitalism, right? It's not that capitalism doesn't work, but it needs to have the ethical component. And that ethical component comes from an organization like the government, having good regulations, good governance around it. So these things are not unrelated. So it's not going away, and climate change is not going away. And if we can't find a way to address climate change, or at least recognize the reality of climate change, and find a proxy to do that, then I think we're going to have a really difficult time, you know, going forward.
I'm wondering if you could capture for us, like even for just listeners, the basic idea of how our economic system drives some of the problems we face, like climate change.
Well, I mean, I think part of it is, again, back to the sort of decentralization, right? The idea of the economic system working best is on a decentralized basis, and that's kind of where capitalism has always succeeded. You know, that's why communism did not work, because, you know, it doesn't work from a top-down perspective. And I think what we lose is sort of the accountability in the sort of what we're, the system in we're now. In the fact that you could have a situation, for instance, like you go through all of 2008 and not a single person was committed of fraud when there was systemic fraud in sort of the mortgage-backed security market. And you have more people arrested on a single day, more journalists or peaceful protesters arrested in a single day in 2020 than you had all of 2008. I mean, it's insane. But the break there is between obligations and rights. You know, we have to bring back those obligations and rights and bring them back to a sort of community level, because these kind of things don't exist in small groups. They can only exist in large groups. And when we sort of disassociate our own actions from others, so, oh, well, that's not me. But, you know, who is it then, right? Because maybe it is you. And if you measure these kind of things in that sort of way, then you can say, oh yes, I actually am polluting quite a bit. Maybe I, you know, don't want to pay that kind of fee, that market price. It's not even a fee, it's not a tax. I don't want to pay that market price for polluting. I want to do something better. More to the point, I want to do something to reduce pollution and be seen as doing that. And I derive esteem from my locality, and people see me doing that, they're going to think higher of me. And that's a win-win for everyone, right?
Does that apply to corporate size as well? I mean, when you talk about larger centralization and then decentralization of communities and government, we also have these corporations that are so huge, they might as well be governments, right? And so are you saying that that would also thrive more if they were broken up into smaller pieces?
Well, you need competition, right? So there's an optimal level of competition to work. And where it doesn't work is when you have oligopolies. And what you see in places that don't enforce the competition laws, you see oligopolies and you see the result. And you could see, point to the US healthcare system versus Switzerland, for example. Or you could look at maybe even IT, you know, with the phone plans, and you come to Switzerland and you're like, oh, I can buy all this data so cheaply. Why can't I do that in the US? Or why can't I change providers, or why my provider won't let me do these things? It has to just do with competition and the way the government regulates competition. And that's the one thing I think the EU's been really extraordinarily good at, is getting people to adhere to the rules and getting everyone to follow the rules, and even more so to get these countries to kind of agree and unanimity on ways to address these things. So, I mean, it is a question of rights and obligations, and it is a question of accountability, and it has to start on a localized level. And once it's strong there, then you have a better governance throughout, and then that's how you address these violations of the corporates, because you have to take the economic incentive of cheating out of it, right? So if the economic incentive is to lobby, you have to change that. I mean, it's that simple. But once that they're entrenched, they're not going to argue against their book, essentially. You know, they're not going to argue against lobbying, because that's what they do. I mean, they're billion-dollar industries. When I speak from my own experience in the oil and gas industry, it's the same thing, right? They have economic interest. And on the flip side, you might even have an economic interest of the people receiving the subsidy, who are not the people you maybe thought were originally. You know, maybe most of it are people receiving fuel subsidies. But is that encouraging the right behavior? Probably not.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. Does it encourage the right behavior?
Yeah.
Probably not. Most of the time.
Well, it's the complexity, right? So if I could boil things down to a color, and I could boil that color down to a 25-meter segment of a city, and if you're out for a run or a walk, and you look on the light pole, and there's an LED light that's reflective of that color, and it's questions whether you go left or you go right, you're going to go down the green path, you know? It's like, because you see the benefit.
We all would, probably, if we had the choice.
Oh, it's an extra minute. I think a little bit, you know, quite a bit cleaner than the other route. I'll do that.
We're like, hold your breath. We need to go down that alley.
Watch out. Here comes the tunnel. That's the one thing we don't.
I actually do have one more question.
Sure.
And that is, I know that you're a father of two young kids, you know, young preteens, basically, or teen and preteen. How do you talk to them about climate change and global issues, and like, what do you feel about their prospects for solving these problems? Because they're the ones that are going to have to deal with all this.
Yeah, that's a really good question, because they're going to be 2050. They're going to be what, 30, around 30.
Yeah. I mean, more than that, they're going to have to pay for it, right? So all the governments are just chucking out debt left and right. You know, somebody's going to have to pay for it, and it's going to start probably with third generation. So it's sort of a complex issue. You know, like, what's engaging to them is the visual one, right? So having an app to see what the air pollution, even if it's just an imaginary number, which they often are for your exact location, but being able to associate that air quality with climate change. I've seen them able to engage on that level. So the app shows them, oh, it's green, and look how much greener it is. Now let's go look at where grandma lives, or let's go look at, you know, whatever. And that sort of engagement, I think, is useful, because it's sort of a segue into climate change and what we can do to improve it. And it's not, you know, it is something we can recognize. We can take action to avoid it out of our own self-interest, but we can also do things to improve it and be able to measure that improvement. It's difficult, right? It's a difficult, anything that's very complex, you need to make it really simple for everyone, not just children.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the challenge. And also, you
and
know,
visible in the first place. Huh?
What, pardon?
Visible.
Oh yeah, easy, yeah, to understand. Make it visible, because, you know,
make it visible.
It's just the way the human brain works, right? It's difficult with dealing with complexity. You need to have that sort of visual cue to allow you to take action. I mean, that's for sure. So it's a challenge. It's a challenge. These things are always a challenge, especially with children, because they're the ones who are going to have to clean up the mess.
I think that's where it's a wrap. What do you think, Steph?
Yeah, I thank you so much for your time
and
explaining the complexity of air pollution and the link to the economic system.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Christian had this very strong notion of collaboration and decentralization, which kind of goes together as a solution, how we can tackle climate change, or in his case, air pollution, very specific problem, the air pollution. And the link to how air pollution basically influences us, every one of us, and if we only would realize how much it does actually on a daily basis, we would automatically do the right decision just for the sake of keeping our health. But we actually don't have the data. We don't have the data to make that decision yet. It's not presented. It's like hidden from us, because cities don't want to, show off how bad the air pollution it basically is.
Yeah, that was crazy when the city doesn't want to actually share the data. They want to solve the problem, but not share the data, which is the power. But, you know, and this idea of community empowerment, you know, it's a theme that keeps coming up over and over in our podcast, you know, with Declan and the Eco Villages, and, you know, Ben and Inez in the transition towns. You know, we have this need to work together to solve these problems if we can see those problems. And I love the technology. Like, he's combining technology and visibility and also community action into one interesting and complex solution. It's what we need, a lot more Christians in the world, you know, that can bring those things together. The other thing he's doing is really, he sees the economics so clearly. Like, you know, it's always been such a struggle for us in New York City to pass these local policies that really put a price on burning fossil fuel. I mean, we want to do it, but it's hard to enforce. It's hard to get people, you know, rallied around those issues. And by measuring those, like, once you can measure something, then you can put a price on it. And so I see how he's facilitating action by just measuring it and showing that measurement so that people can see it and act.
It doesn't have to be a price tag as automatically as in dollars. It could be in any other form of currency. That could also be a local currency or a carbon token or whatever it is, for a city, working for a city. It doesn't actually have to, has to be the dollar.
Yeah, it could be access to a park or some kind of city service or, that's something we didn't ask him, but we know that these other ways of trade or the other ways to store value could be really well employed in something like this. Well, for me, another big interesting point came at the very end about kids, you know, and having to rely on kids to solve these problems and providing ways that they can see the problems in the first place really makes a difference. Because if kids continue to grow up like we did, where we weren't able to see those externalized costs, or we have to work so hard to see them, it's very difficult to know what to do. But once you can see it, even as a kid, you know, then your creative juices can begin to flow and you can develop skills to address those problems.
I guess a kid growing up in 2050 kind of turns back and says, man, what did you do in 2020? Why did you just not get rid of air pollution?
Yeah, well, I think we're saying that now about the people that grew up in 2016, you know, in the 1960s. You know, why did we let these huge industrial companies, these, you know, car manufacturers, you know, pollute as much as they did? We knew by the 70s that that was not a good idea. We knew that pollution was getting bad. But again, I think he points to this centralized economic system where companies are so huge and they're lobbying policy. And so right under in front of our eyes, the system shifted so that we really can't control what's going on. We don't have a direct experience anymore. So I love the idea of decentralization and transparency. Giving power back to the people.
Me too. What comes up to me, you know, is a saying. I unfortunately only know it in German, but it's and it came up to me a couple of times during this pandemic. Der Krug geht zum Brunnen, bis bricht. Which, what is the thing you have on the table where you put water in? It's the ceramics.
The pitcher.
How do you call it? A what?
A pitcher. Yeah.
Yeah. So the pitcher goes to the fountain until it breaks. Does this make any sense to you?
Interesting. The pitcher goes to the fountain until the pitcher breaks or the fountain breaks.
Yeah, which basically means humans. You do. What you are used to do until you break, until you have a big crisis, until you can no longer do what you used to do.
I see. Yeah. That's well, hopefully we can turn that around and do what we need to do before we break. That's the goal.
Cheerio.
Okay.
We're an independent, listener-supported podcast.
Thanks to our producer, Riley Paul.
Support us by rating this episode and sharing with all your friends.
And to learn more, join us at potofgold.world.
I'm Stephanie Overbach.
And I'm Mel Wymore.
Thanks for listening.